Michelle Thomas, and welcome to My Shit Therapist. Just to flag, in this episode, we're going to be discussing suicide and alcohol addiction. If that's not something you want to hear about today, just skip this episode and come back to us next time. Today, I'm talking to Ross McPhail. Ross's brother, Jake, took his own life at the age of 18. Since then, Ross has been heavily involved in a local charity called Ask for Jake, which offers peer-to-peer support and free suicide prevention training resources for parents of people with mental health issues. We talk about the work that Ask for Jake does in their local community in Braunton in Devon, and how Ross takes care of his own mental health while working to improve conditions for others. As ever, if you've got a mental health story that you'd like to share on the podcast, send me an email at myshittherapist@gmail.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at myshittherapist. Are you ready? Okay, let's get into it. So what is a mental health support worker then?
So I do two different things. So for my main career, I work in assisted living accommodation, and then with the charity work I do, we do a thing called peer-to-peer support.
And the charity, is that Ask for Jake?
That is, yes. So that's in July of 2019, I lost my brother to suicide. And then since then, this charity has developed and, you know, taken massive strides at the moment in our local community for suicide prevention and training.
And that's just, I'm so sorry to hear about your loss, first of all. What kind of work is the charity doing at the moment?
So currently we do training. So we currently have training available for people to learn counselling skills, so that they're able to talk to people safely that have mental illness, as well as the safe talk training, which they're very similar. But we offer those two types of training as well. We've got the peer-to-peer support. So if anyone's in crisis or just needs a general conversation, they can message us on our Facebook page. And as well, we host a talk shop on a Saturday where people can come down and there'll be a trained member of staff for which they can talk to. It doesn't always have to be around their mental health. It can just be they come down for a general chit-chat.
Like, first of all, the thing that strikes me is that you're, you know, after you know, a family tragedy, after losing your brother, you've made it your life's work to help other people, which is an amazing and commendable thing to do, and to help people get counselling and to help people access help. How have you been able to, or have you spoken to a therapist, for example? How do you look after your own mental health? As well as
I went to
other people's.
So basically, I was a little bit down in the dumps, let's say. I wasn't really achieving much in life during the period after the Jacob passing. So I went to see a therapist once. I found them absolutely fucking useless.
Really?
It's difficult for me because, you know, it's always the case that the people that talk the most don't like to talk about themselves. You know, so I kind of sat there and it was very hard, and to an extent I thought pointless to sit there and answer my own questions, which I guess is the whole point of therapy. And looking back, I might have not always had the most open mind on it. But yeah, I sat there and basically talked my way into answering my own questions and thought, fuck this, I'm not paying £56 for the hour when I can sit at home and maybe do it myself. You know, it worked for some people and that's fantastic, but for me personally, it didn't. But to be honest with you, I dealt with it surprisingly well on a personal level in terms of my own kind of recovery. And the best thing I did was actually get involved with the charity, because there was a period of about 8 months when it started that I was not involved at all. You know, I kind of was moping around with no real purpose, and I started to get involved a lot more. And it's suddenly been moving on from there to where I've got the absolute biggest fire lit up my ass, where I've got to be doing something every second of the day, otherwise I'm not really doing anything at all. So no, it was just getting involved, I think, was the best thing for me, because, you know, me and Jake used to always say that if he does one thing in his life, he wants to be more successful than me. But he's now allowed me to be the successful person that I should be, you know, through the charity work that we're doing.
So You say you got involved with the charity, so you weren't involved in setting it up initially, or were you?
No, that was more my mum and a couple of members of the community, because what the charity was first set out for was a peer-to-peer support parent group for grieving parents and parents with children that were mentally ill. Because that's the one thing that my mum found that wasn't available was an actual avenue for her to speak and talk with other like-minded people. And it's just from there where we saw a gap in what the mental health services were offering. And we like said that we filled that gap. We're that kind of signpost in intermediary range for people that, either want to contact us for support, and then we can guide them on to other services, whether that be, medical professionals or other charities or things like that. And also providing the people in our own community with the skills needed to talk to people and to talk to people that are suffering. So I wasn't as heavily involved in the beginning. I was quite wary too, because I think for me, I thought it would be a constant reminder of Jake. But I've jumped in now. I'm a committee member, and we're doing really good work, and it's been really positive for me as well.
Amazing. What kind of people use your services? What's your biggest demographic, would you say? And is it the same now? Is it mostly for peer-to-peer support for parents of children with mental ill health, or is it broader than that?
It's broader than now, and it's evolved. So we don't really have a main demographic as such. I think it is still quite heavily parent orientated, and a lot of the work we still continue to do is signposting, providing parents with those skills. But also, the work that I'm doing is I'm trying to engage with people of around the kind of 16 to 24 demographic, people my age, to hopefully normalize that for a lot of people. I was a stereotypical I'm okay person for a long period of my life. I've always been this kind of bubbly, outgoing kind of person that will chat the hind legs of anyone that cares to listen. It was keeping up that impression, and it was difficult during that time because we were such a small community. I think we're the largest village in the UK, but it's still a village. It was then to build my own image that wasn't Jake's brother. And it was then reinventing myself as more than just Jake's brother, which is where the charity work came in, so important that I was one of those recognizable people from Ask for Jake. But yeah, for a long period of time, I did try and pretend that everything was okay. And then by speaking to people, I started to pick up small tips and things like that, is that, there is no right way of dealing with grief. And that was one of the big things for me, is that I wasn't crying. I wasn't, unable to sleep. I was drinking heavily, but at the time I didn't think that to be a big issue. But it later turned out that I couldn't continue on that path I was on. I was drinking a couple of bottles of wine a night just to cry. Whereas, I started to listen to things and take in information and realize the way I was functioning wasn't wrong, but it wasn't right.
And you saw a therapist once and paid 56 quid, Jesus.
It was private, that was the issue.
Did you ever go on antidepressants? Did you ever get any other kind of medical help for anything?
No, not really. It was just support from the people around me. I'd gone through a relationship at the end of 2019 that kind of broke down because of my drinking and the way I was carrying on. And I kind of took a step back and started to look at things. And if I'm being completely honest with you, lockdown was the best thing that ever happened to me. So there's a positive in that. I started to take a look at myself, and I wasn't able to do the things I normally did. It was sometimes quite, deconstructive to me. And I just took a look with all the help that I'd been kind of taking in slowly, maybe not realizing it. I started to take a look at myself and realize that I can't continue like this. And then lockdown happened, and I found that I had all this spare time and my behaviors were changing. I wasn't finishing work and then going down to the pub, or, Saturday nights going out into town weren't happening anymore. And It was honestly, I think, very good for me, lockdown personally, because it changed my behaviours completely.
I do think that there's is an interesting thing. There's definitely something to be said for, I think it's gone either one of two ways. Either people have started drinking a lot more during lockdown,
yeah,
or people have been drinking a lot less and feeling the benefits of that.
Yeah, completely.
How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 22.
You're 22. So in 2019, so you were 20 at the time.
Yeah, I was 20 and Jake was 18 at the time. Like I say, it was a slow journey for me, but I'm happy I am where I am now.
How did what has the response been like to your charity work? And how is that? So I imagine, do most people who get in touch with you to access the charity, to access support from the charity, are most of them people who you know, so from the village and the surrounding area, or are they from all over the place? And what's the response been like?
So most people that contact us normally either do so on someone else's behalf, of how they can help them and whether we get in contact with them. There is a minority of people that still do contact us personally, but a lot of it is like we do, is signposting, providing the resources necessary for people to achieve the right help, because that can be the scary thing, is that, like, mental health in online, and you get so many different articles and you get so many different websites to visit that it's all just quite overwhelming.
Yeah, it's so much. And when you're, it's a lot, it's like a full-time admin job. When you're at your full ability cognitively and emotionally and psychologically, but when you're vulnerable, or when you're like underperforming, that's a horrible way of putting it, but when you're not at your proper capacity mentally, it's a massive task.
It is. And you know, that's one of the hardest things, is that when people reach out, it's often one of the most difficult things they ever do, and they don't want to get it wrong, so they end up not doing it. So a lot of the work we do is signposting to charities that, you know, we've either worked with or got a response from that we found to be positive, and we can pass that on. Or, you know, we can provide support from ourselves, you know, and that be from conversation and the talk that we offer and things like that. And to be honest with you, the response has been, you know, amazing. You know, it's been, to be honest with you, completely incredible. It wasn't the response that I thought we'd get, but the whole village is behind us. You know, it's in the mouths of everyone that is, you know, within a close vicinity of us. We've had it's been absolutely incredible to continue to do what we do through people fundraising for us. You know, doing, whether it be a marathon on our behalf and raising funds, there's so much that people are doing for us that, you know, we're often the first people that they think of when it comes to raising funds, which is absolutely incredible. It's a lot easier to do what we do when we've got the support of the people around us.
And what are your long-term plans with the charity? What do you want to achieve?
So, you know, I always jokingly say I want to end mental health, or want to end mental illness, should I say. You know, but that's a goal that will never go away. The thing that I want to achieve on a personal level is to get people to start talking. And I know that's all people ever say, is that people should begin to talk about mental health and talk about themselves. But, you know, it's something that I want to do, because at the end of the day, when you normalize those conversations, people don't suffer in silence. And then on a charity perspective, is we want to make sure that everyone in our community, and maybe looking at extending that, is trained to have the skills, resources available to support those people, and can do it safely as well. Because under that can be an issue as well, is that make sure that people are talking safely.
When you say you're talking safely to people, is it basically like a psychological first aid course to say this is how you talk to someone who's in crisis?
The main one we've got at the moment is that Safe Talk training, which is, as the name suggests, we'll make sure that you're speaking to that person safely, but also you're safe doing so. Because, you know, that's very important to us, is that those conversations are happening, but happening safely. But as well, we're looking at working to make our own course that people can go on that's more tailored to our community.
So is it quite a rural community where you are?
It is. We're right on the coast down in Devon. My girlfriend's from Birmingham. She can't believe that we've not got a Starbucks in our town centre. So it's tailoring to the individual needs of the people of our community.
And what is a safe conversation and what is an unsafe conversation?
A safe conversation is using the right words. I know that's something I'm always told off for is not using the correct language. And making sure what you're saying isn't providing a different meaning to those words. To make sure your words are taken for actually what they mean instead of what they could mean. And just making sure that person is getting the right information with what you're saying in terms of support and then to potentially go on to have other assistance, whether that be medical or not. So it's just making sure that those conversations are structured properly and the right wording is being used.
That's really interesting. Can you give me an example of sort of wrong and right wording?
So big one I get told off for a lot is mental health industry. And mean that their mental illness is out for profit for another individual. Another one is committing suicide, because committing almost entails a crime. Because up to the 1980s, it was a crime to try to end your life and you would have been imprisoned.
Up to the 1980s?
Yeah, up to the 1980s, committing suicide was actually a crime. So the words we like to use are either completing suicide, taking your own life, just to make sure that, you know, that language that you're using is safe.
It's making things as uncomplicated and unambiguous as possible, isn't it? To someone I know when I've been, like, when I was really depressed, I just did not have the bandwidth to comprehend, like, multiple layers of meaning in the simplest sentence. So it's just it's making people feel safe. And what are the risks to the speaker? Why do you need to make sure that the person who's approaching or who is speaking to someone with a mental illness, what's unsafe about that? Potentially unsafe about that?
I'll give it some context. 3 months before Jake passed, I was pretty much his sole carer as such. You know, I was aware that everything that Jake was doing, and, you know, it hurt me a lot when Jake passed, because it felt like I failed him. And that was why it took me so long to be involved with the charity, was because I thought I had that duty of care there towards him and I'd failed him. And it's important to make sure that person is having that conversation, similar to maybe what I had done. Make sure that person is aware that the person who may choose to end their life or complete suicide, it was a decision that they had made. And to make sure that someone similar that may have felt the same to me, feeling that they failed, wouldn't have those feelings, because they knew the conversations they were having were the best that they could possibly be. To make sure that person isn't feeling any kind of failure or guilt with what they were talking about.
That's not something I've ever considered before. But of course that's a risk. I mean, because it's a trauma, isn't it? It's a form of trauma that they have undergone.
You know, it's not too similar to, you know, medical professionals when completing surgery, and if they've had a surgical error or whatever it may be that ends up a loss of life. You know, it's, you just want to make sure that everything you're doing is the best it possibly can be. Because I know how awful I felt after the, you know, the months after Jacob passing.
If there were a listener who wanted to help someone who was in the position that you were in after Jake had died, what would your advice be to the person who wants to help?
Give them a little bit of time, you know, because forcing them to kind of go out and try and, you know, get back to a little bit of normal life. I think I tried to do, you know, I was back to work 3 days after Jake had died, and ended up.
I saw the video where you said
and
that.
And having to take 6 weeks off afterwards because, you know, I was just burying down those feelings.
Do you still drink?
Yeah, I still drink. Yeah, I'd attended a few Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. But, you know, I probably can't tell you the last time I was drunk like I used to be, because for a long period I thought, you know, going out, getting drunk, blacking out and not remembering how you got home was how people went out and drank. And that was my kind of association with alcohol.
And in fairness, in the UK, between the ages of 18 and 20, that's about right, actually. That's how our culture is built around alcohol. You know, it's the whole, you know, drinking cider behind a skip with your mates from the age of 15. We don't have any sense of we're not French. We don't have, oh, there's a bottle of red wine at the table at lunchtime, and of course the children can have a sip if they want it, and it's there. No, we're just like,
we can write it from our
reserve,
parents.
Reserve. But then when we hit it really hard, I think.
I think for me, it was on the nights that I didn't go out, or for whatever reason I couldn't, it was seeing how my mates kind of drank and were out without me. And, you know, kind of seeing that maybe my way of going out or my belief of how I went out wasn't exactly right. You know, and seeing the people around me that weren't having 8 pints, going home, going to work in the morning, you know, or getting so drunk that someone's got to come and walk you home. But again, I don't want to say that's how I dealt with it, but it was almost correct in that aspect, is that, you know, I preferred who I was around that time after I'd had a drink. You know, I was happier, I was more pleasant to be around, and I didn't have to force it, because when I was drunk, I was in a good mood, you know, whereas opposed to not having to go to work and, you know, thanking all those people for saying that they're thinking about me, or, you know, for wishing well or apologizing for everything that I'd gone through. It was, I could go out, have a few pints, and I was actually in a good mood rather than having a fake one. But, you know, I'd had no measure to stop. It was more until they wouldn't give me any more.
But your relationship with booze now is that you'll like buy a couple of bottles to have in the house, but if you don't want it, if it's there, it doesn't have to get drunk.
You know,
it can just be in the fridge.
Yeah, you know, because having a Scottish dad, you know, there's always whiskey around, or, you know, there's always some bottles of ale somewhere. But for me now, it's you know, there are days when I enjoy a beer after work, and that beer tastes just as good as it ever did. But, you know, for me now, it's not almost a nightly occurrence, which it used to be. Or, you know, it was an every Saturday night occurrence, and then a Wednesday top up or something like that. It is just something now that I can enjoy, as opposed to having it feel like a necessity for when I came home. I gave a radio interview the other day. You know, is what would Jake think of this? And, you know, I kind of gave a response. I'm sure he's looking down at me pleasantly and he's enjoying the work I do. And the fact, you know, I knew the bloke and he fucking hated it and he called me a loser. But it's, you know, you meet people in life through different scenarios and things like this. And there's one lady that I'll always cherish forever for a positive outlook on life. So she's a lady that is involved with the charity, and she has been sectioned, and she's used the services and things like that. And, you know, she's been down that place, but she has completely turned it around into, you know, she now works on the ward where she was as a patient. And she does all this wonderful stuff and everything like that. And it's kind of, her outlook is very infectious. It took me a while to get there, but, you know, being around her or being supported by her, I think, has, you know, completely changed my outlook on what life can be, because you can completely bounce back from those dark places and turn it into a positive, which I think is what I've done, and definitely what she has.
Thank you so much to Ross for joining me. To find out more about the amazing work that Ask for Jake does, visit their Facebook page. Until next time, take care and take your meds. Bye!